Dwayne Thompson and Marianne Ignace. They made themselves our guests. Power relationships in the interior plateau region of the Cordillera in the fur trade era. BC Studies number 146, summer 2005. As read by Marianne Ignace, the co-author. In the first decade of the 19th century, land-based traders entered the Cordillera region from the east, where they encountered numerous Aboriginal nations living in a highly diverse environment. Various authors have examined the nature of the relationship between these fur traders and the Aboriginal nations of the Cordillera region during the succeeding 50 years until colonial government was established on the mainland of British Columbia in 1858. Most recently, Cole Harris has argued that the European fur traders entered the country with superior firepower and technology, an ideology and language of power, European-derived concepts pertaining to the social control of barbarous people, and an integrated coercive common commercial strategy. His book details the violence perpetrated against Aboriginal peoples to enable Europeans to gain and maintain control, and he offers multiple examples of hangings, whippings, murder, and gunboat bombardments. Seemingly benign techniques of control, such as gift-giving and arranging marriages between company servants and chiefly families, were inevitably backed by the demonstrated reality of retribution that was fearless, implacable, and severe. Harris concluded that whatever native peoples wanted to do about it, the traders established their presence, and the balance of power in the Cordillera tilted fairly inexorably towards them. Harris gives slight consideration to one significant reality of the Cordillera region. It was home to, and under the control of, numerous Aboriginal nations, which were distinguished from one another by language, social structure, economy, military power, values, and lifestyle. These nations were also differentially exposed to European technology and military power. The dynamics of the evolving power relationships between European traders and these communities were complex and are not easily generalized. To narrow the focus, this paper concentrates on the fur traders' relations with the Salish-speaking nations that controlled the interior plateau region of the Cordillera and attempts to understand the internal workings of those nations. According to the 1910 memorial to Sir Wilfrid Laurier, given by the chiefs of the interior, these nations treated the European traders as guests in their homelands, schlitemch in the language of the Squapmuch. The Salish nations offered the traders security for their persons and trade goods as long as their guests conformed to the economic, legal, and social regimes of the respective host communities. As Jennifer Brown and Elizabeth Vibert have noted, the encounter between Aboriginal peoples and Europeans has been a long and complex engagement of mutual dialogue, communication, and miscommunication, with documents and authors existing in multiple contexts. Aboriginal people and Europeans participated in their mutual encounter within the context of each other's particular worldview and social and political agenda. We approach the study of the history of Aboriginal-European relations during the first half of the 19th century by looking at the intersection of written documents with ethnographic texts that contextualize the practices and actions of Aboriginal peoples within their cultural meanings. We attempt to explore the meanings of encounters between fur traders and Aboriginal peoples by explaining Salish language terms that have precise, culturally relevant meanings relative to particular interactions and social practices. We examine what Renato Rosaldo has called converging lines of evidence in order to make a case for the enactment of Aboriginal notions of sovereignty and control over land and resources during the first half of the 19th century. We postulate that this approach will contribute to a better understanding of the issues of Aboriginal sovereignty, rights, and title as interpreted by legal and political institutions in Canada and by Aboriginal groups. Salish nations inhabit the Upper Columbia River and Middle Fraser regions of the Cordillera, and they are separated from the coastal region by the Cascade and Coast Mountains, through which the Columbia and Fraser Rivers flow on their way to the sea. They include the Flathead and Pend'Oreille nations of present-day Montana, the Coeur d'Alene of Idaho, the Kalispell, Colville, Spokane, St. Paul, Nispelum, Methow, Penskowas, Wenatchee and St. Ect of Washington, and the Lakes Sinicht, Okanagan, Similkameen, Tsquatmukh, and Tlkatmukh and Tlatlimukh of British Columbia. These groups differed from one another in some respects. Some were frontier nations that maintained a significant military capability, while others enjoyed their protective shield. Some controlled or had preferential access to extremely productive fishing sites and relied more on the products of the fishery than did their hunting-oriented neighbors. And some adopted the equestrian culture of more completely than others. However, they all spoke languages of the same family, traded extensively with one another, intermarried, aided their neighbors in war or times of need, and, driven by the laws and protocols of collective ownership of resources and resource sharing through kinship and alliance, enjoyed some reciprocal access to one another's territories. They also maintained similar resource tenure regimes, justice and religious systems, and social practices. Not surprisingly, their interaction with the fur traders reflected these similarities and minor differences. Three companies traded furs in the Columbia and Fraser watersheds, and each left a record of its initial dealings with the Salish peoples. The first individual to enter the region was David Thompson, representing the Northwest Company. And he was followed within 2 years by David Stewart and Alexander Ross, employees of the short-lived Pacific Fur Company. The Northwest Company purchased the assets of the Pacific Fur Company in 1813, assumed many of its employees, and operated its posts, including Fort Okanagan, Spokane, and Thompson River, for nearly a decade before merging with the Hudson's Bay Company. In 1821, the Hudson's Bay Company acquired the assets and many of the employees of the Northwest Company, and George Simpson, governor of the Hudson Bay Company, assumed responsibility for operations in the Columbia District. David Thompson first encountered Salish people when he entered Flathead Territory in 1809. Before him lay the territories of the several interrelated Salish nations of present-day Montana, Idaho, and western Washington, estimated in 1823 to number over 5,000, but according to more recent population estimates, comprising as many as 68,000 people. For two seasons, he traded and explored in the Upper Columbia, frequently meeting with small parties of Aboriginals who offered such assistance as lending horses and canoes, supplying dried salmon, berries, and venison, and offering geographic information. On his famous return trip down the Columbia in 1811, he met other Salish groups along the banks of the main river. His first stop at a St. Paul camp was similar to others. He spent time smoking, eating, and making speeches. In his narrative, Thompson commented on the speeches given on this occasion. The speech being ended and interpreted to us was thanks for our arrival and hoping we would bring them guns, ammunition, axes, knives, awls, and not to forget steels and flints with many other articles. They were able and willing to hunt and would be able to pay for everything they wanted, but at present they had only their hands to procure food and clothing and much more to the same purpose, all too true. I then explained to them my object to know how this river was to the sea, and if good, very large canoes with goods of all kinds would arrive, by which they would be supplied with clothing and all they wanted if they were industrious hunters. The St. Paul people returned on two occasions that evening, the first time to smoke and to give Thompson presents of roots and berries, and the second time to sing and dance for the voyagers. In interior Salish culture, welcome dances represent notions of respect and goodwill towards people who are not kin. They acknowledge and endorse the other group, often through such gestures as dancers holding up open-palmed hands. This movement is often accompanied by lyrics and vocal remarks in songs and implicitly invites a reciprocal relationship. The Europeans may have noted the positive intents of these actions and songs, but did not understand their precise cultural meanings. The dancing lasted about an hour, interrupted by short speeches by the chief, performed with great goodwill so that they would be preserved in the strong rapids they had to run on their way to the sea. And thus it went. Thompson continued down to the mouth of the Columbia, and then he returned, meeting other Aboriginal groups. On his upstream trip, he traveled up the Snake River and then overland to Spokane and Kettle Falls, where he met Colville and the Okanagan people, and continued with issuing greetings and meeting protocols. When Thompson's Northwest Company party returned via the Snake River, a Pacific Fur Company party under David Stewart, which had accompanied him upriver, continued to ascend the Columbia and Okanagan rivers and then proceed overland to Kamloops. Stewart's colleague, Alexander Ross, claimed that Aboriginals in village after village between the Wenatchee and Kamloops were eager to host traders. For example, at the mouth of the Okanagan River, he reported, "A great concourse of Indians followed us all day and encamped with us. After acquainting them with the object of our visit to their country, they strongly urged us to settle among them. For some time, Mr. Stewart resisted their pressing solicitations, chiefly with a view of trying their sincerity, but at last consenting, the chiefs immediately held counsel and then pledged themselves to be always our friends, to kill us plenty of beaver, to furnish us at all times with provisions, and to ensure our safety and protection." It is clear from both the Thompson and Ross records that the Salish desired European manufactured goods to better protect, feed, and clothe themselves, and that they ensured the fur traders' safe passage and protection to gain access to those goods. Harris claims that superior firepower, fort construction, the use of armed brigades, and the ability to interdict the use of ammunition placed military power firmly in European hands. Whatever the balance of power was elsewhere in the Cordillera, in the Upper Columbia it was clearly on the side of the Aboriginals, and for more reasons than just disparity in numbers. Salish tribes of the Upper Columbia were large, had long traditions of warfare and raiding, and were capable of defending their territory and or retaining their access to resources. The Blackfeet were the common enemy of the Upper Columbia tribes. Sometimes the Spokane and Flathead joined with the Nez Perce to raid Blackfoot territory, returning with scalps, prisoners, and horses. Warfare, partly related to differential access to guns and the ability to defend or extend tribal territory, was also prevalent between tribes resident on the west side of the mountains. In one recorded case, the Okanagan and their allies, including members of the Spokane, Suquamish, and Nskepmuk, warred on the Stetlimuch Nation in 1823 to avenge the murder of one of their chiefs, who was killed while serving as an emissary of the Hudson Bay Company. In another, a lingering animosity between the Tunaha Nation and the Lakes and Okanagan threatened to develop into a full-scale war near Fort Colville in August 1826. A contributing factor to violence during the land-based fur trade was the presence of the parties of American traders, British freemen, and Iroquois who roamed the eastern and southern fringes of Flathead territory and who were frequently pillaged or killed by competitors or aggrieved victims of previous violence. The Interior Plateau was a violent place in the early 19th century, and although no serious trouble of any kind occurred with the natives, the whites held the natives in wholesome fear. This is according to Alexander Caulfield Anderson. Conducting trade safely in an organized, militarized environment obviously presented challenges to the early land-based traders, but they relied on their protected status in Salish communities. Examples from Fort Spokane illustrate this relationship. Ross Cox described his arrival there in August 1814. The trading goods had been exhausted long before, and the Indians had been upwards of 2 months without ammunition. Our arrival, therefore, was hailed with great joy. The whole tribe assembled round the fort and viewed with delight the kegs of powder and bales of tobacco as they were unloaded from the horses. A large circle was formed in the courtyard, into the center of which we entered, and having lit the friendly calumet, smoked a few rounds to celebrate the meeting. A quantity of tobacco was then presented to each of the men, and the chief delivered a long oration. The chief's speech, as presented by Cox, is too long to repeat here, but it began with the words, "My heart is glad to see you. My heart is glad to see you. We were a long time hungry for tobacco." The oration concluded with a community dancing, singing a song of welcome to the good white men, and promising to hunt. Cox recalled that at Fort Spokane they seldom closed the gates at night. Ross reported that many trading posts were enclosed by pickets and that this enclosure was dignified by the name of the fort. But he goes on to say that the Aboriginal people of the area had free ingress and egress at all times, and that all business was transacted within the fort walls. Similar reports are found in the journals and reports of the Pacific Fur Company and Northwest Company in other Salish communities. Trade was generally conducted in an open, friendly environment. Fur traders did fortify posts, often to protect themselves from collateral damage from an Aboriginal war. Only after an incident in 1829, when a coalition of Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, and Nez Perce threatened war on the Colville natives, was Fort Colville enclosed by pickets. When Ross Cox fortified the Okanagan post in 1816, he made a point of noting the previous conditions. The buildings at that period were very poorly defended, and were the natives actuated by feelings of hostility, they would have easily robbed the fort and destroyed McGillivray's little party. This circumstance will show in the strongest point of view their friendly feelings towards us. After the 1821 merger, the Hudson Bay Company attempted to maintain and reinforce this security relationship with the various Salish nations in the Upper Columbia. George Simpson was determined to rationalize the operations of the Columbia Department and to reduce the costs of personnel and transport by reducing the number of workers at the interior posts. A chief trader, one clerk, and 12 men would now suffice at the Thompson's River Post rather than the former complement of chief trader, two clerks, and 20 men. While he planned a summer establishment of one clerk and four men, after 1826, that post was abandoned completely during the summer hiatus while the Packhorse Brigade transported the furs out and returned with the annual outfit. Simpson was counting on conciliatory yet firm and judicious conduct, not the military strength of his establishments, to effect this change. A critical element of George Simpson's retrenchment strategy involved negotiating a comprehensive agreement with every Aboriginal nation on whose land the Hudson's Bay Company maintained a post. On his trip up the Columbia River in April 1825, he attempted to establish the conditions of the relationship with the Salish tribes, and his accounts of these meetings are instructive. On 4th April, Simpson held an interview with a chief from the Thompson's River Post area, perhaps Quilila, who had traveled approximately 10 days to meet with him. His journal reads, "Had a long interview with the principal chief of Thompson's River, who came hither purposely to see me. He is the most respectable, manly-looking Indian I ever saw, appeared much pleased with what I said to him, and promised faithfully to back and support us with all his power. I made him a present of a medal bearing the company's arms, which he seemed to prize greatly, and gave him a few other trifles. We parted excellent friends, and this interview will go far towards the safety of the establishment and future good conduct of the Indians. Simpson next traveled to Fort Spokane, where he interviewed eight chiefs belonging to the Flathead, Kootenai, or Ktunacha, not a Salish tribe, and Spokane nations. Back at the strategic Kettle Falls, Simpson met and negotiated with the Salmon chief for permission to establish a post. This record is important because Fort Colville was the only post in the interior that Simpson was directly involved in founding, others having been established by preceding companies under different circumstances. He made no show of power and issued no threats. While the people were carrying, I went to the chief's lodge about a mile above the carrying place, had an interview with him and some of his principal followers, and intimated my wish to form an establishment on his lands, provided he undertook to protect it and assured us of his friendly disposition. He received the proposal with much satisfaction and offered me the choice of his lands in regard to situation of quantity. We selected a beautiful point on the south side about three-quarter mile above the portage, where there is an abundance of fine timber and the situation eligible from every point of view. I lined out the site of the establishment 150 feet square on the bank, facing and commanding a view of the river, and likewise marked out the garden. Simpson also requested access to the very productive fishery at Kettle Falls, but the Salmon chief denied his request, remarking that the fish were necessary to his own people. The Hudson's Bay Company could use the forests and fields for good production and could trade for fish. Having assured himself of the goodwill and military protection of the various Salish host communities, Simpson thought that he had protected company interests. His policy towards the Salish was in accordance with instructions written to him in March 1825. Every exertion should be used to obtain the goodwill and confidence of the natives in all countries to the west of the Rocky Mountains, particularly on the Columbia. Every assurance should be given them that our object is confined to carrying on a trade which must be beneficial to them, and that we have no desire to possess or cultivate their lands beyond the little garden at the trading houses. 2 years later, the company policy was reiterated when Simpson was instructed to secure the Indians on our side by conciliating and kind treatment. In 1838, James Douglas also wrote of attaching the First Nations to the Hudson's Bay Company by kind and liberal treatment. Obviously, competition with the United States for the Oregon country was an element of the Hudson's Bay Company attempts to secure Aboriginal friendship and protection. After all, the Salish, not the Hudson's Bay Company, held military power in the region. The example of the Thompson's River Post illustrates the connection between military security and post maintenance among the Salish over an extended period. Simpson initially thought that the principal cause of the Thompson's River Post being kept up was the danger to which the New Caledonia outfits and returns would be exposed from the natives of Thompson's River if we were to withdraw from their country. Having established the post and elicited promises of good behavior, the brigade route was thought to be secure. The post itself was open to complete destruction during any summer because the Hudson's Bay Company abandoned it and entrusted the key to the front gate to a local Aboriginal chief. The only recorded instance of loss of company property during the summer hiatus was in 1826. Archibald MacDonald reported, "Not being too well satisfied with the conduct of the two Suquamish chiefs, Cortepot and Tranquille, here last spring, the key to the post, contrary to custom, was not given to the former, but to Nikwala, another chief of the Okanagan tribe, which gave some umbrage to the Suquamish, and the consequence, as might be expected, was not the entire security of the fort and the few little things left therein, With respect to the fort, however, it cannot be said they have acted with any wanton violence, for at best 'tis but a frail concern, and as such we find it. The Thompson's River Post was a frail concern, because the Hudson's Bay Company did not maintain it properly. James McMillan explained this in 1822. This is not being a post kept up in summer, and no certainty of finding it unburned on arrival in the fall, the men have little to do except just keeping the fort in repair. His successor, Archibald MacDonald, once had his men make minor repairs to the fort, but he noted that the whole premises are falling into decay from below, the fort being generally overflowed during the summer flux. The post must have deteriorated further, because when Donald Manson arrived in the late summer of 1841, he reported, "I am sorry to say I found the fort here in a wretched state of defense, the house and stores being completely rotten, and were it not for the number of props placed against them, they would have been down long ere now. The fort pickets and bastions are even worse than this." Manson and his successor did construct a new post, which was completed in November 1842. 9 years later, problems recurred, as Paul Fraser reported. "Had a gale of wind that threw down all our stockade, set all hands to erect them with new posts," he wrote. The men on this occasion spent all of 2 days employed with the stockade. On his arrival in Kamloops the next year, Paul Fraser found all the stockades down, and he complained that no establishment could be in a more dilapidated state than this one was on my arrival. It is obvious from this record that for the greater part of its existence, the Thompson's River Fort offered no protection from local Aboriginal people for either company personnel or property. Rather, the traders depended on their host communities for military protection in order to facilitate their trading and transport activities. One can scarcely imagine a dozen men operating from one of the frail and vulnerable Hudson Bay Company forts in the midst of a community of several thousand Aboriginal people managing their affairs in any other way. Generally, the Hudson's Bay Company was secure in the posts that enjoyed Salish protection, but company personnel did face harassment when they left the area of the local chief's influence. Small parties carrying supplies or communications between posts or traveling en durine to trade for furs or dried salmon suffered harassment and pillaging at distant locations. In 1826, war between the Chilcotin and Carrier around Fort Alexandria extended to the Bridge River area of the Fraser River, where the Hudson's Bay Company procured much of its dried salmon, and this made trade difficult and the First Nations troublesome. The Suquamish in the Green Lake area between the Thompson's River and Alexandria frequently harassed Hudson's Bay Company personnel. These communities were not hosts of the traders, had made no commitments for their security, and apparently did not see the benefit of allowing trespass through their territory. With the Hudson's Bay Company operating by sufferance among the Salish, company personnel necessarily either submitted to local resource tenure regimes or negotiated exceptions to local regulations. As the Hudson's Bay Company operated in different jurisdictions, one would expect to find it operating differently in the respective communities. And an examination of Hudson's Bay Company access to food resources demonstrates this to be the case. Fish, in particular the anadromous salmon, was the staple in both the Aboriginal and fur trader diets throughout the interior. And Hudson's Bay Company access to this resource illustrates the company's submission to the different community resource tenure regimes. Archibald MacDonald explained the role of salmon at Thompson's River, but his remarks applied equally to other posts, especially before agriculture became viable. "Dried salmon is the staff of life and fortunately seldom fails. However, we come in for very little of what is caught in these streams. Every fall and winter, from 4 to 5 trips are made to the Fraser's River, a journey that usually takes from 12 to 15 days. From the beginning of August till our return to the depot the ensuing June, about 12,000 salmon are consumed exclusively for the district, and last year 1,500 of that number were taken to Okanagan. Each fish from Fraser's River, those from the Columbia are larger, split and dried with the backbone out, weighs 1 pound and 200. The usual horse load will cost 5 pounds. Three such salmon are allowed a man per day, two for a woman, and one for a child when supplied out of the company store. The Aboriginal peoples of the plateau, including at its core the Salish nations, had distinct laws and protocols with regard to the access to and use of salmon fishing resources. The prevailing law of ownership held that salmon fishing sites were under the ownership of the entire tribe or nation, with a local group or band headed by its political chief and or resource chief exercising stewardship over the fishing ground. In some areas, including that of the Stlatlimukh and the northern Suquamish, individuals' ownership or first choice over particular fishing rocks or weir sites had become established at the time of contact. The latter is significant for our discussion of fishing at Fort Alexandria. For purposes of comparison, Hudson's Bay Company's salmon procurement activities at Fort Alexandria, within Carrier and on the margins of Suquamish territory, are presented along with evidence from the Thompson's River, Colville, and Spokane posts established within the Salish jurisdictions. Joseph McGillivray reported on Aboriginal fishing technology at Alexandria. The salmon fishery commences about the middle of July and ceases in October. This is a busy season for the natives, for upon their industry in saving a sufficiency of salmon for the winter depends their chief support. Their method of catching salmon is ingenious and does not differ much from that practiced by the upper natives of the Columbia. A certain part of the river is enclosed by a number of stakes about 12 feet high and extending about 30 feet from the shore. A netting of rods is attached to the stakes to prevent the salmon from running through. A conical machine called a vorveau is next formed. It is about 18 feet long and 5 feet high and is made of rods about 1 1/4 inches asunder and lashed to hoops with wattup. One end is formed like a funnel to admit the fish. Two smaller machines of nearly equal length are joined to it. It requires a number of hands to attach these vorveaux to the stakes. They are raised a little out of the water, and the salmon in their ascent leap into the boot or broad part and fall into the enclosed space where they are easily killed with spears. This contrivance is admirable, calculated to catch fish. And when the salmon is abundant, the natives take from 800 to 900 daily. The Alexandria Post personnel were active in operating this Aboriginal technology. In 1827, the Hudson's Bay Company had acquired a weir suitable for spring fishing and employed an Aboriginal lad to assist in its operation and maintenance. For the 1827 summer fishery, company servants constructed their gear with Aboriginal assistance in raising wattup, trying the vorveau, and setting the weir. The company also provided assistance to some of the principal men in setting or resetting their weirs in anticipating or sharing their returns. A series of incidents occurring in 1827 illustrate the terms under which the Hudson's Bay Company fished. Relations with the host community had deteriorated over the summer. The company was accused of taking fish out of a nearby weir. The post's Aboriginal fisher was threatened in an attempt to drive him from company employ, and whether the Indians are successful or not, the post received not a fish. When McGillivray proposed paying for the loan of a weir, since the fishery was over, he was rebuffed. These conflicts derived from at least two sources: the general scarcity of fish that season, with the attendant Aboriginal frustration, and the ignorance of the company with regard to the Aboriginal fishing tenure regime. The latter reason became increasingly clear late in the season when McGillivray wrote, "Weir, 35 salmon. The Volvo being in a bad situation, I determined on altering its position by removing it below the point at an early hour. The men cut and brought the pickets to the fort, and as they were about finishing off, nearly all the Indians opposed our departure. The Capo Blue, on this occasion, distinguished himself in the eyes of his countrymen and Canadians by remarking our weir should not be set below, and raised the skin from one of his hands, said the chief, meaning me, was not invulnerable, but flesh and blood like themselves. Giving a war whoop, he got himself under arms, and this appeared to be the signal for mischief. The most insignificant scoundrels showed a temper to second their leader. I sent for the old chief, Chinlaskut, and represented the absurdity of his countrymen in opposing us, in a cause where certainly there was no ground for open hostilities. The place was unoccupied, and not likely to be occupied this season, and I thought there could be no insuperable objections. Salmon we must have, as the Indians would give us none. The noise was quieted. The chief returned after having consulted with his friends and said we might set our weir below. Huleskut, being the proprietor of the spot, would not come when I sent for him, but returned a message we might have the place. He continued later, Huleskut, claiming the place where our Vorvo is located, asked for some ammunition this morning for granting us permission to set our weir there. I have already paid three individuals. Community acceptance of this agreement was less than complete. Aboriginals cut a 15-foot opening in the company's weir on 9th of October, broke it again on 11th of October, and continued to express dissatisfaction with a decision to allow the weir to be placed downstream. The 1827 fishery ended without the issue being resolved. In succeeding years, the Hudson's Bay Company became progressively less interested in fishing for salmon directly, likely because of the difficulties of access and insecurity of supply relative to its own increasing agricultural production. The evidence from Fort Alexandria indicates that the Hudson's Bay Company was generally able to gain direct access to the fish resources in the immediate vicinity of that post, although it was held to account when it transgressed community regulations. The Hudson's Bay Company certainly did not enjoy the same access to resources in the nearby posts in Salish territory. The Thompson's River post was even more dependent on salmon and other country produce than was the Alexandria post, because the company personnel did not successfully engage in agriculture until the mid-1850s. So dependent was the post on dried salmon that the men's diet occasionally became a source of concern. The Suquamish relied on the summer run of salmon to obtain certain of their storable winter provisions, and the arrival of the annual run was invariably mentioned in the journals. Salmon were available to Suquamish on the Thompson and Fraser Rivers between May and October. The May to July runs involved Chinook salmon, which were apparently of greater significance before the disastrous 1914 Hell's Gate slide reduced the run dramatically. The main runs during July and August were sockeye, which were wind-dried for winter usage. September and October saw the coho arrive, the ones observed by traders, which were also significant for winter preservation. Some descriptions of Suquamish technology and practice have survived in fur traders' notes, as well as in ethnographic reports, and these reflect methods that are still in practice. The scoop net, or stukchen, was the preferred implement in fast-moving, murky waters, or rapids, like those of the Fraser River. And George McDougall wrote, "No news from the Atna, Suquamish, in the village immediately south of Alexandria. I hope they are taking plenty of salmon, the water being high, not interfering with them, as they use only the scoop net." On a slow-moving river, such as the Thompson, the Suquamish used flambeaux, or chechkum, pitch lanterns to attract the fish, and spears, both usually operated from canoes, and enabling a catch of from 200 to 300 salmon per hand per night. Spear fishing from shore with a gaff, a three-pronged spear, or a harpoon was another technique often used in the clear waters of the North and South Thompson Rivers. The Suquamish employed weirs and fence traps elsewhere in their territory, such as at Barrier and Adams River. These weirs were constructed under the authority of village chiefs and resource stewards, who supervised construction, maintained the barriers and traps, and communally distributed the returns. Despite the presence of Aboriginal fishing activities at the doorstep of the fort, the surviving Thompson's River journals from 1822 to 1858 contain not one reference to any Hudson's Bay Company employee fishing. The post purchased all of its fresh fish from the Suquamish who lived in the vicinity of the post or elsewhere on the North and South Thompson Rivers. For supplies of dried salmon, the post relied on fish obtained from the Stadtimch and the Fraser River at the fountain near the mouth of the Bridge River and from the Inchkapmuch between Ashcroft and Lytton. Company personnel felt their dependence keenly, especially with regard to fish obtained from distant Aboriginal groups. Peter Skeen Ogden wrote regarding the situation on the Fraser River and his futile attempt to make the post independent after the murder of chief trader Samuel Black. Men by fours and fives have been in the habit of being sent to trade salmon on Fraser River and other parts, and on almost every occasion they have been pillaged and insulted, and from the disparity of the numbers, 1 to 20, they have been obliged to submit, and the Indians, finding that with every crime they committed, no action was taken, have gone on step by step to the crime of murder, and poor Black is the sufferer. To do away with this Darwin system in future, I have provided 60 sacks of provisions for the use of the establishment, and strict instructions will be left with Mr. Todd that until a general understanding exists with the natives, the men will not be sent on trading excursions, and I'm fully confident that when the natives discover we are independent of their salmon, they will bring it to the fort. The Suquamish clearly excluded the Hudson's Bay Company from directly exploiting the fish resource. On one occasion, an Alexandria-based Hudson's Bay Company servant traveled to Suquamish territory to fish, but he returned empty-handed because the Suquamish had threatened to break his canoe if he persisted. Chief Factor Douglas discussed Suquamish and Atlkatmuk attitudes to their resources early in the gold rush. A new element of difficulty in exploring the gold country has been interposed through the opposition of the native Indian tribes of Thompson's River, who have lately taken the high-handed, though probably not unwise, course of expelling all the parties of gold diggers composed chiefly of personnel from the American territories who had forced an entrance into their country. They have also openly expressed the determination to resist all attempts at working gold in any of the streams flowing into the Thompson's River, both from a desire to monopolize the precious metal for their own benefit and from a well-founded impression that the shoals of salmon which usually ascend those rivers and furnish the principal food of the inhabitants will be driven off and prevented from making their annual migration from the sea. Douglas also reported on the Hudson's Bay Company's position with regard to resource use in Suquamish and Inchkapmuch territory. The officers of the Hudson's Bay Company in that quarter have received orders carefully to respect the feelings of the natives in that matter and not to employ any of the company's servants in washing gold without their full approbation and consent. Douglas was reiterating a long-standing Hudson's Bay Company practice of not exploiting the resources of a Salish nation's territory except by purchase or trade, and he reaffirmed company recognition of exclusive Suquamish authority and management rights to their resources. Throughout the period under study, the Suquamish maintained the exclusive right to fish in their territory. Only after Douglas negotiated an agreement with the Suquamish Nation during the gold rush on the Thompson's River did Hudson's Bay Company employees begin to fish directly, building weirs near the fort and employing nets for river and lake fishing. Fort Colville, established on the most productive Aboriginal fishery on the Upper Columbia, was the great trade emporium of the region. John Work described the unique basket used to catch fish attempting to overcome the waterfall. Visited the falls today where the Indians are fishing. They are now taking about 1,000 salmon daily. They have a basket about 10 feet long, 3 feet wide, and 4 deep of a square form, suspended at a cascade in the fall where the water rushes over a rock. The salmon is attempting to ascend the fall, leap into the basket. They appear to leap 10 or 12 feet high. When the basket is full, the fish are taken out. A few are also taken with scoop net and speared. The company respected Aboriginal jurisdiction and refrained from fishing at Kettle Falls, although not without expressing frustration with the authority of the salmon chief, the appointed caretaker of fishing resources of the community. MacDonald wrote, "Our salmon chief has located himself in the mountains to the north of us, masticating deer's meat to his heart's content, and sends word from time to time to his less fortunate dupes onto no account to go near the falls or trespass on the established law, until it be his will and pleasure to say the thing is very good." At Fort Colville, usually enough fresh and dried fish were available through trade to meet the company's requirements, and agricultural production gradually reduced dependency on the fish resource. Hudson's Bay Company access to the fish resource was somewhat different at Spokane than it was at Thompson's River and Colville. Salmon were a major resource for both the Spokane and the Hudson's Bay Company personnel, and both parties maintained barriers on the Spokane River. In the Spokane District Report for 1822-23, Alexander Kennedy wrote, "There are such numbers of the natives who resort to the principal fishing places on the Spokane River during the salmon season, whose existence depend upon them, that we can never get any stock to purchase from the natives, nor will they allow us to catch any quantity ourselves, so to lay up a stock for winter, so we are dependent on Fort George for the principal part of the food." While the Hudson's Bay Company faced some quantitative restrictions to fishing and trading, it apparently negotiated permission to fish for salmon in the river near the fort. To replace its existing barrier, the Hudson's Bay Company constructed a strong, durable facility requiring dozens of person days of effort. Although the Hudson's Bay Company had unimpeded access to weir returns early in the summer, an incident occurred in August 1822 that is significant with regard to Spokane resource tenure. "This morning, Mr. Lewis and Mr. Finnan MacDonald went down to see our barrier. There happened to be some Indians there spearing the salmon coming up the river. Mr. MacDonald spoke to them, but they being in a canoe, put all his threats at defiance. He lost no time in springing into the water and broke the canoe. The chief of this place was much displeased and went and broke down 9 of the palisades of the garden. His brother being more attached to the whites went down and drove him away from the garden. He then wished to come down to the fort for to dispute with us. He was prevented by the Indians. We, not knowing all their intentions, got our cannon loaded, but one of them informed us it was only him who was displeased with what he had done. We killed 80 salmon in our barrier. There was a guard kept all night in case some of the Indians were badly disposed." The Hudson's Bay Company had offended community norms. MacDonald was attempting to exert exclusive property rights to the fish that had accumulated below the Hudson's Bay Company barrier, and that had made the chief very agitated. At the same time, the chief was undoubtedly restrained because the dispute was not worth the cost of alienating the company, especially as the Spokane feared that the Hudson's Bay Company was about to relocate to Kettle Falls. The Hudson's Bay Company clearly conformed to Aboriginal resource tenure regimes. and it procured essential food resources only with Aboriginal permission. At Fort Alexandria, outside Salish territory, an extended family-based private property regime is evident. The company could buy or lease all that was required in order to fish, sites, technology, raw materials, and skilled labor, and it could also organize the production of the staple product in a variety of ways. The company violated local community norms on at least one occasion, but generally the local Aboriginal resource tenure regime accommodated it. At the Thompson's River Post, which was in the core of Suquamish territory, and at Fort Colville in Flathead Salish territory, the host Aboriginal community organized its fishing activity communally by recognizing a village head as the local resource steward, under whose authority fish were taken, dried, and distributed. At these locations, the Hudson's Bay Company was excluded from direct access to the fishery. The Fort Spokane experience was exceptional within Salish territory. There, the community granted the Hudson's Bay Company limited direct access to salmon, but objected when it violated the terms of the agreement by claiming exclusive ownership of the fish gathered below the company weir. Within the territories of the Salish Aboriginal nations, the somewhat different conditions of access to the staple resource allowed by the respective tribes may be considered to arise from difference of situation. Hudson's Bay Company officials have been accused of being high-handed and arbitrary, and of using retribution to force their will on Aboriginals in the Cordillera. Fur trader actions, when evaluated against English legal precepts and practice, may appear arbitrary, brutal, and illegal, but traders were operating in Aboriginal, not European space. The various Salish nations and others in the Cordillera maintained a justice system that applied in cases of theft, infringement on property rights, murder, adultery, and other crimes. Criminal acts, including property crime and homicide, were perceived as acts by a member of an extended family against a member of another social group, be the victim inside or outside the Aboriginal nation. Crimes committed by individuals always involve the dimension of future social relations between groups. In order to ensure the security and well-being of its members, a community needed to restore harmony after a crime was committed. It was the responsibility of leaders of the community, the appointed chief and his or her advisors, to ensure the restoration and maintenance of viable social relations between members of the perpetrator's group and members of the victim's group. In a time of an international incident or crisis, a group may have tolerated a mediator from a third nation. For example, the Suquamish may have accepted an Okanagan who was related by kinship. To seek justice following a serious crime, a major theft or homicide, Aboriginal communities held a council that gave advice based on practice and good sense, known as Tkunum Iplaten in Suquamish. To find evidence, hear both sides, and rule on retribution, often in the form of compensation. Significantly, the victim's group had a role in achieving retribution. Punishing a convicted criminal required the cooperation and advice of the victim's family, even to the extent of what J.P. Reed refers to as privileged killing in cases of murder revenge. As well, the perpetrator's family or group had to initiate discussion and to offer and agree to the form of punishment. The appointed punishment often involved payment of goods by the perpetrator's family to the victim's family. In severe and far-reaching cases, such as the death of Nkwala's father, cited below, revenge through warfare was the chosen punishment. The fact that payment to the victim's family was the most commonly chosen form of retribution does not imply that the perpetrator was not subsequently punished by and within his or her own group. The social group, community, or extended family could still choose to ostracize, evict, or in other ways punish the offender. The perpetrator's group is guided by a concept known in Tsukwatmukhchin as Eyamshchut. Under Eyamshchut, the decision not to follow the counsel of wise people who allocated retribution and thus to neglect to meet one's obligations would haunt the guilty party, as well as his or her kin, who share social responsibility for a crime committed by a member of their group. Alexander Ross, who knew the Salish community well, reported, "Among these people, there are no regular punishments instituted for crimes or offenses of any kind, yet all transgressions are cognizable and punished by their laws, so as to ensure security to life and property." David Thompson elaborated on who was responsible for obtaining justice. "An Indian thinks the revenge of murder belongs only to the kin of the murdered, and this because having lost a good, as something desirable, society has nothing to do with it. Those not of the kin say it was a foolish action, and there the matter stands. But a foreigner, or one of another tribe to kill another Indian, is to call the injured tribe into the quarrel, if they are strong enough, but otherwise they let the matter pass, as what cannot be helped." Two types of crime, theft and murder, are observable in the fur trade records pertaining to Salish communities. Ross was categorical on the subject of theft with the Okanagan Nation. "Theft in particular is held in the utmost abhorrence, so it rarely occurs among them. The property of each individual, even of the slave, is held sacred. Traders frequently left goods in the care of Salish people in complete safety. Hudson Bay Company records contain examples of actual or suspected theft, but members of these Aboriginal host communities were rarely the perpetrators. In fact, the Hudson's Bay Company journals are replete with examples of the return of horses that had been abandoned or lost on the trail, and of local First Nations people recovering property stolen by strangers. Interference with brigades, pillaging, and stealing of company horses generally occurred in non-host territory or under conditions of starvation. This may explain the reaction of the Okanagan to the Sampoil theft of Northwest Company horses, as related by Cox. The Okanagan chief assisted in the recovery of the goods by directing Cox to their camp, and then he tongue-lashed the starving, non-resident thieves, but left it to the fur traders to reclaim the horses and to impose a penalty. Ross observed the concept of compensation, explaining that if one committed a crime, there was but one way to ward off the meditated blow, to regain his friendship, and that is by a peace offering or present, for here property pays for all offenses. With regard to the offense of murder, Ross noted, "If one Indian kills another, the murderer saves his life by making a suitable present to the nearest relative of the deceased, and they draw no line of distinction between accidental or justifiable homicide and willful murder. Death caused in any way by another is looked upon in the same criminal light." An example in Hudson's Bay Company records of a compensation settlement for murder is found just outside Salish territory, and it involves the Suquamish people. After two local Aboriginals murdered a Suquamish lad, the Fort Alexandria journalist reported, "The Talcotan receive a visit from the Suquamish, who request that the former give property to pay for the body of the murdered lad and that they will make peace. The next day he reported a successful negotiation. In the absence of appropriate negotiated compensation, the perpetrator could expect the second penalty, physical retribution by the kin or tribe of the victim. When Pilkmutluk, the father of Chief Nkwala, was murdered, representatives of the offending tribe twice attempted to arrange compensation but were rebuffed, and thereafter the tribe suffered retribution by members of Aboriginal groups connected to the chief. On those occasions when Europeans were involved in the murder of an Aboriginal person, they were expected to conform to community standards. An example of this involves Chief Nkwala's son, who who was killed by a Hudson's Bay Company official in 1846. John Todd reported that the death had caused an immense sensation among the numerous relatives of the young man. He transferred the officer of the district and wrote that he was doubtful that the incident could be settled without the sacrifice of property. Todd later recalled that he had feared some sanguinary act of revenge that must have immediately ensued, either on the part of the father himself or of his tribe. When an Aboriginal person murdered a white fur trader, the Hudson's Bay Company officials understood that it was their responsibility to respond in terms acceptable to the host community. A.C. Anderson reported, "In the case of individual acts of aggression or outrage, and especially in the case of murder, retribution was inflexibly exacted. But punishment was visited only on the guilty, and then usually through the medium of the tribe, or with their approval and cooperation." Francis Ermatinger, in charge of the Thompson's River Post, provides an example of an officer operating within the bounds of the Aboriginal justice system. He reported, "While I was at Okanagan in January, a fellow who had killed a man here some years ago stole a horse. Immediately on my return, although we mustered only five strong, I had him shot. The chief of the place talked a little upon the occasion in hopes of extorting property, but Dears and I set them all at defiance and appeared so determined that they at once lowered their tone and even confessed we had done right." Europeans were loath to accept compensation in payment for the murder of one of their own, and consequently they employed retribution against the individual or family of the perpetrator, sometimes in conjunction with the closure of a post or interdiction on the sale of ammunition, actions designed to bring social and economic pressure on an entire community. Similar to that of their hosts, their policy was to never allow an insult or outrage to pass without retaliation and punishment, while at the same time to pursue judicious, firm, and conciliatory measures. The First Nations host communities may not have seen the wisdom of regularly refusing compensation or abandoning opportunities for trade, but retaliation was a judicially acceptable response. The Samuel Black murder in 1841 demonstrates how criminal cases were settled within Salish jurisdictions. A young man of the Suquamish tribe killed Chief Trader Black inside the Thompson's River Post, apparently because he thought the fur trader was implicated in the recent death of his uncle. The Hudson's Bay Company imposed an embargo on the sale of ammunition to the local Suquamish communities, imported foodstuffs in an attempt to make the post less dependent on the Suquamish and surrounding nations, and dispatched a party under the direction of Donald McLean to capture the murderer, with the stated intent of publicly hanging him. The McLean campaign was unsuccessful in capturing the killer, despite visiting his known haunts unannounced, destroying family property, and chasing him around the country. John Todd was then assigned to Thompson's River, assisted by an energetic young Métis, Duncan Cameron. Cameron briefly kidnapped the murderer's child, which threw the whole camp into great distress, indicating that this was not a culturally appropriate enforcement method. Todd seems to have knowingly adopted Salish legal procedures to bring about a resolution of the issue. He attempted to mend relations with the Suquamish community by returning their horses, compensating them for lost property, and asking for their cooperation in hunting down the killer. He attempted to engage a local Aboriginal man to deliver the culprit into his hands, but the local chief temporarily halted that initiative, likely because appropriate negotiations had not occurred. The old partisan of the whites, the Okanagan chief Nakwala, then addressed the Suquamish community in a long, impassioned speech, reminding them that they had killed their guest, benefactor, and father, and that they must not resist until they had all brought his murderer to justice. His attempt at mediation was designed to restore good relations with the traders, the immediate impetus likely being that ball and powder were needed for the impending fall hunt. After that, a delegation of principal men, including some of the murderer's relatives, visited Todd, and a heated discussion ensued. Eventually, the delegation grew silent, apparently convinced of the justice of the Hudson's Bay Company cause. At the end of the meeting, a band member came forward and promised to decoy the murderer into the hands of the Hudson's Bay Company. At the appointed time, while the capture was being effected, upwards of 20 Indians assembled about the fort. They came into the hall in the course of the day and quietly smoked their pipes, until they heard some account of the murderer. The young man was captured and then shot while trying to escape, after which the Indians reportedly reassembled in the hall and quietly smoked their pipes, acquiescing fully in all that was said on the subject. John Todd knew that the only way he was going to get justice was through the Suquamish community's procedures and protocols. He also recorded details implying that he understood the nature of the murderer's last words. As he was dying, he called out that he did not want to die, but he deserved death, and that they must not revenge it. Some uncertainty exists in the historical record about Todd's payment to the individual who assisted in the capture of the so-called murderer. Salish protocol requires retribution to be paid by the perpetrator's group to the victim's group, not the reverse. In his history, Todd claims that he offered payment, but that the man replied, "No, the Indians told me that I was to take nothing, but that I ought to give up the murderer." However, in his journal, Todd states that Grangoul received trade goods, which he distributed in part among a few of his relatives. Clearly, in the recorded occasions of crimes against property or person in Salish territory, the Hudson's Bay Company followed Aboriginal legal precepts. It assumed its responsibilities for punishing perpetrators because that was required in Aboriginal jurisdictions. Not to have extracted retribution or accepted compensation would have marked the company as unable to protect itself. Regarding the Black murder, Simpson wrote, "This unfortunate state of affairs, it is thought, has arisen from an ill-judged forbearance on our part in not punishing many cases of misconduct, such as horse thieving, pilfering from encampments, etc., which have been committed by the natives of late years, a forbearance they ascribe to shyness or timidity, instead of the proper cause, a disinclination to have recourse to measures of severity." The historical record makes it clear that the fur traders were valued, protected guests in Salish territory, and that they conformed to Salish community requirements. Other evidence speaks to Salish perspectives on their relationship to the fur traders. Approximately 100 years after David Thompson first entered their territory and 50 years after a colonial government was established in British Columbia, the leaders of the interior Salish communities held an urgent meeting to prepare a series of addresses to federal officials, including a memorial to Prime Minister Sir Wilfrid Laurier. Chiefs of the Suquamish, Okanagan, and Nklamuk nations presented their memorial to Prime Minister Laurier at Kamloops in August 1910, providing their view of the history of relations between First Nations and Europeans and outlining their grievances regarding recent illegalities and mistreatment. This remarkable document was signed by numerous chiefs, including senior hereditary chiefs John Tulhitza of the Okanagan, David Basil or Basil Dick of the Tlochtaus or Bonaparte Band in the Suquamish Nation, Petit Louis of the Tkamloopsumch or Kamloops Suquamish, and John Titlinitsa of the Entlkapmuch. The memorial presents their firsthand collective memory and perspective on the previous 100 years of their history. The Salish called the fur traders real whites, to distinguish them from the various settlers, colonial agents, and missionaries who followed in the colonial era. The memorial reads, in part.
The real whites we found were good people. We could depend on their word, and we trusted and respected them. They did not interfere with us nor attempt to break up our tribal organizations, laws, and customs. They did not try to force their conceptions of things on us to our harm, nor did they stop us from catching fish, hunting, etc. They never tried to steal or appropriate our country, nor take our food and our life from us. They acknowledged our ownership of the country and treated our chiefs like men. They were the first to find us in this country. We never asked them to come here, but nevertheless, we treated them kindly and hospitably and helped them all we could. They made themselves, as it were, our guests. We treated them as such and waited to see what they would do. We found they did us no harm. Our friendship with them became lasting. Just 52 years ago, the other whites came to this country. They found us just the same as the real whites had found us, only we had larger bands of horses, had some cattle, and in some places we cultivated the land.
A knowledge of the concept of guest in Salish culture is crucial to understanding the Salish response to the arrival of the fur traders. In the Suquamish language, guests are called Tsklitimch, guests or those invited, to distinguish them from Kseltkten, relatives or family, who encompass the wide and intricate network of kinship that stretches over the entire nation, even between nations. Kseltkten are all those people who, by birth or affiliation, have title and or access privileges to the nation's territory. Tsklitimch are individuals who are without such rights. They are considered to be at the mercy of their hosts. As an elder explained, guests who come into your country are pitiful. They have no home, so you allow them to camp nearby, and you invite them and feed them. The status as guest includes the notion of reciprocity. Within Salish society, when a person invites someone or a group of people as a guest, it is quietly understood that, in time, they will return the favors they received. The traders were considered Tsklitimch within Salish territories, and the Flathead, Colville, Suquamish, and other nations who negotiated agreements with the traders maintained their protective shield over the pitiful guests within their respective territory. Throughout the fur trade era, the Salish nations maintained societies that were strong when measured by numbers of inhabitants, military capacity, effective resource tenure regimes, and functioning judicial and social systems. The Salish nations welcomed the small number of fur traders with whom they traded for European products, especially guns, ammunition, tobacco, and textiles. Remarkably few frictions developed, especially after relations stabilized on the basis of negotiated protection and conditional access to the various tribal territories and resources. The traders knew that they operated in Aboriginal-owned and controlled country. The historical record indicates clearly that Hudson's Bay Company personnel relied on the protection of the Salish nation in whose territory they found themselves, obtained staple food resources on terms dictated by the laws of the Aboriginal group, and conducted themselves within the parameters of their host's judicial principles. Furthermore, representatives of the Salish nations of the Interior Plateau, looking back in 1910 over 100 years of their interaction with Europeans, confirmed that they considered the traders to be guests and that the traders' behavior and attitudes conformed to that status. According to the chiefs, it was not until a new wave of white people invaded the country during the 1858 gold rush that the guest-host relationship was violated. We do not argue that the Salish-speaking people's world was static. As the fur trade era closed, Aboriginal peoples faced both challenges and opportunities that we have not considered in this paper. These included serious population decline, resource depletion, the introduction of new foods, technologies, and economies, the accommodation of large numbers of settlers who arrived in Salish territories, the introduction of new religious beliefs, and the imposition of oppressive colonial and subsequently federal and provincial policies. For the first half of the 19th century, however, on the critical issues of power relations and the institutional integrity of Salishan nations, the record is clear. From the perspective of both the authors of the Memorial to Laurier and the Salishan chiefs of southern British Columbia who had themselves been raised in the fur trade era, and the fur traders who left written accounts of their dealings with their hosts, the fur traders' relationship with the Aboriginal nations was one of dependence and conformity in every respect to the requirements of the Aboriginal communities. This observation is significant for two reasons. First, in the ongoing scholarly debate regarding which party held power on the Pacific slope during the fur trade era, the answer seems clear, at least in Salish territory in the interior of Oregon country. It was the Aboriginal groups who exerted control and power. Second, from the perspective of Aboriginal rights, Canadian courts are much interested in questions surrounding the proof of exclusive occupancy of the land and the control of resources and laws in 1846, when British authority was finally established in British Columbia, vis-à-vis its European and American competitors. Based on our limited examination, we conclude that the Salish nation's control and exclusive occupation of lands and control of laws was largely undiminished by fur traders until the gold rush initiated significantly changed conditions and different circumstances.